Chapter 17. In mid-June of 1941, on the second to the last school day of the term, Vian was at the blackboard, conjugating a verb when she heard the now familiar putt-putt-putt of a German motorcycle.
"Soldiers again," Gilles Fournier said bitterly.
The boy was always angry lately, and who could blame him? The Nazis had seized his family's butcher shop and given it to a collaborator. "Stay here," she said to her students, and went out into the hallway. In walked two men, a Gestapo officer in a long black coat, and the local gendarme, Paul, who had gained weight since his collaboration with the Nazis. His stomach strained at his belt. How many times had she seen him strolling down Rue Victor Hugo, carrying more food than his family could eat, while she stood in a lengthy queue, clutching a ration card that would provide too little. Vian moved toward them, her hands clasped tightly at her waist. She felt self-conscious in her threadbare dress, with its frayed collar and cuffs, and although she had carefully drawn a brown seam line up the back of her bare calves, it was obvious that it was a ruse. She had no stockings on, and that made her feel strangely vulnerable to these men. On either side of the hallway, classroom doors opened, and teachers stepped out to see what the officers wanted. They made eye contact with one another, but no one spoke. The Gestapo agent walked determinedly toward Monsieur Paretsky's classroom at the end of the building. Fat Paul struggled to keep up, huffing along behind him. Moments later, Monsieur Paretsky was dragged out of his classroom by the French policeman. Vian frowned as they passed her. Old man Paretsky, who had taught her sums a lifetime ago and whose wife tended to the school's flowers, gave her a terrified look.
"Paul?" Vian said sharply. "What is happening?"
The policeman stopped.
"He is accused of something." "I did nothing wrong," Paretsky cried, trying to pull free of Paul's grasp.
The Gestapo agent noticed the commotion and perked up. He came at Vian fast, heels clicking on the floor. She felt a shiver of fear at the glint in his eyes.
"Madam, what is your reason for stopping us?"
"He's a friend of mine."
"Really?"
he said, drawing length from the word, making it a question.
"So you know that he is distributing anti-German propaganda?"
"It's a newspaper," Paretsky said. "I'm just telling the French people the truth. Vian, tell them."
Vian felt attention turn to her.
"Your name?"
the Gestapo demanded, opening a notebook and taking out a pencil. She wet her lips nervously.
"Vian Mauriac."
He wrote it down.
"And you work with Monsieur Paretsky, distributing flyers?"
"No," she cried out. "He is a teaching colleague, sir. I know nothing about anything else."
The Gestapo closed the notebook.
"Has no one told you that it is best to ask no questions?"
"I didn't mean to," she said, her throat dry.
He gave a slow smile. It frightened her, disarmed her, that smile. Enough so that it took her a minute to register his next words.
"You are terminated, madame."
Her heart seemed to stop.
Excuse me?
"I speak of your employment as a teacher. You are terminated. Go home, madame, and do not return. These students do not need an example such as you."
At the end of the day, Vian walked home with her daughter and even remembered now and then to answer one of Sophie's non-stop questions, but all the while she was thinking, "What now? What now?" The stalls and shops were closed this time of day, their bins and cases empty. There were signs everywhere saying, "No eggs, no butter, no oil, no lemons, no shoes, no thread, no paper bags." She had been frugal with the money Antoine left for her. More than frugal, miserly, even though it had seemed like so much money in the beginning. She had used it for necessities only: wood, electricity, gas, food. But still it was gone. How would she and Sophie survive without her salary from teaching? At home, she moved in a daze. She made a pot of cabbage soup and loaded it up with shredded carrots that were soft as noodles. As soon as the meal was finished, she did laundry, and when it was hanging out on the line, she darned socks until night fell. Too early, she shuffled a whiny, complaining Sophie off to bed. Alone, and feeling it like a knife pressed to her throat, she sat down at the dining table with an official postcard and a fountain pen. "Dearest Antoine, we are out of money, and I have lost my job. What am I to do? Winter is only months away." She lifted the pen from the paper. The blue word seemed to expand against the white paper. Out of money. What kind of woman was she to even think of sending a letter like this to her prisoner of war husband? She balled up the postcard and threw it into the cold, soot-caked fireplace, where it lay all alone, a white ball on a bed of gray ash. No, it couldn't be in the house. What if Sophie found it, read it? She retrieved it from the ashes and carried it out to the backyard, where she threw it into the pergola. The chickens would trample and peck it to death. Outside, she sat down in Antoine's favorite chair, feeling dazed by the suddenness of her changed circumstances and this new and terrible fear. If only she could do it all over again. She'd spend even less money. She'd go without more. She'd let them take Monsieur Peretsky without a word. Behind her, the door creaked open and clicked shut. Footsteps, breathing. She should get up and leave, but she was too tired to move. Beck came up behind her. "Would you care for a glass of wine? It's a Chateau Margaux, 28. A very good year, apparently." Wine. She wanted to say yes. Please. Perhaps she'd never needed a glass more. But she couldn't do it. Neither could she say no, so she said nothing. She heard the thunk of a cork being freed, and then the gurgle of wine being poured. He set a full glass on the table beside her. The sweet, rich scent was intoxicating. He poured himself a glass and sat down in the chair beside her. "I am leaving," he said after a long silence. She turned to him. "Do not look so eager. It is only for a while, a few weeks. I have not been home in 2 years." He took a drink. "My wife may be sitting in our garden right now, wondering who will return to her. I am not the man who left, alas. I have seen things." He paused. "This war, it is not as I expected. And things change in an absence this long, do you not agree?" "Oui," she said. She had often thought the same thing. In the silence between them, she heard a frog croak and the leaves fluttering in a jasmine-scented breeze above their heads. A nightingale sang a sad and lonely song. "You do not seem yourself, madame," he said, "if you do not mind me saying so. I was fired from my teaching position today." It was the first time she'd said the words aloud, and they caused hot tears to glaze her eyes. "I drew attention to myself." "A dangerous thing to do." "The money my husband left is gone. I am unemployed, and winter will soon be upon us. How am I to survive, to feed Sophie and keep her warm?" She turned to look at him. Their gazes came together. She wanted to look away, but couldn't. He placed the wine glass in her hand, forced her fingers to coil around it. His touch felt hot against her cold hands, made her shiver. She remembered his office suddenly, and all that food stacked within it. "It is just fine," he said again. and the scent of it, the black cherries and dark rich earth, and a hint of lavender wafted up to her nose, reminding her of the life she'd had before, the nights she and Antoine had sat out here drinking wine. She took a sip and gasped. She'd forgotten this simple pleasure.
"You are beautiful, madame," he said,
his voice as sweet and rich as the wine.
"Perhaps it has been too long since you heard that."
Vianne got to her feet so fast, she knocked into the table and spilled the wine.
"You should not say such things, Herr Captain."
"No,"
he said, rising to his feet. He stood in front of her, his breath scented by red wine and spearmint gum.
"I should not."
"Please,"
she said, unable to even finish the sentence.
"Your daughter will not starve this winter, madame," he said.
Softly, as if it were their secret accord.
"That is one thing you can be sure of."
God help Vianne, it relieved her. She mumbled something, she wasn't even sure what, and went back into the house, where she climbed into bed with Sophie, but it was a long time before she slept. The bookshop had once been a gathering place for poets and writers and novelists and academics. Isabel's best childhood memories took place in these musty rooms. While Papa had worked in the back room on his printing press, Maman had read Isabel's stories and fables and made up plays for them to act out. They had been happy here for a time, before Maman took sick and Papa started drinking.
"There's my ease. Come sit on Papa's lap while I write your Maman a poem."
Or maybe she had imagined that memory, constructed it from the threads of her own need, and wrapped it tightly around her shoulders. She didn't know anymore. Now it was Germans who crowded into the shadowy nooks and crannies. In the 6 weeks since Isabel had reopened the shop, word had apparently spread among the soldiers that a pretty French girl could be found often at the shop's counter. They arrived in a stream, dressed in their spotless uniforms, their voices loud as they jostled one another. Isabel flirted with them mercilessly, but made sure never to leave the shop until it was empty. And she always left by the back door, wearing a charcoal cloak with the hood drawn up, even in the heat of summer. The soldiers might be jovial and smiling, boys really, who talked of pretty fräuleins back home and bought French classics by acceptable authors for their families, but she never forgot that they were the enemy.
"Mademoiselle, you are so beautiful, and you are ignoring us. How will we survive?"
A young German officer reached for her. She laughed prettily and pirouetted out of his reach.
"Now, monsieur, you know I can show no favorites."
She sidled into place behind the sales counter.
"I see you are holding a book of poetry. Certainly you have a girl back home who would love to receive such a thoughtful gift from you."
His friends shoved him forward, all of them talking at once. Isabel was taking his money when the bell above the front door tinkled gaily. Isabel looked up, expecting to see more German soldiers, but it was Anouk. She was dressed as usual, more for her temperament than the season, in all black. A fitted V-neck black sweater and straight skirt with a black beret and gloves. A Gauloise cigarette hung from her bright red lips, unlit. She paused in the open doorway, with a rectangle of the empty alley behind her, a flash of red geraniums and greenery. At the bell, the Germans turned. Anouk let the door shut behind her. She casually lit her cigarette and inhaled deeply. With half of the store length between them and three German soldiers milling about, Isabel's gaze caught Anouk's. In the weeks that Isabel had been a courier, she'd gone to Blois, Lyon, and Marseille, to Amboise and Nice, not to mention at least a dozen drops in Paris recently, all under her new name, Juliette Gervaise, using false papers that Anouk had slipped her one day in a bistro, right under the Germans' noses. Anouk had been her most frequent contact, and even with their age difference, which had to be at least a decade, maybe more, They had become friends in the way of women who live parallel lives, wordlessly, but no less real for its silence. Isabel had learned to see past Anouk's dour expression and flat mouth, to ignore her taciturn demeanor. Behind all that, Isabel thought there was sadness, a lot of it, and anger. Anouk walked forward with a regal, disdainful air that cut a man down to size before he even spoke. The Germans fell silent, watching her, moving sideways to let her pass. Isabel heard one of them say, "Mannish," and another, "Widow." Anouk seemed not to notice them at all. At the counter, she stopped and took a long drag on her cigarette. The smoke blurred her face, and for a moment, only her cherry red lips were noticeable. She reached down for her handbag and withdrew a small brown book. The author's name, Baudelaire, was etched into the leather, and although the surface was so scratched and worn and discolored, the title was impossible to read. Isabel knew the volume, Les Fleurs du Mal, The Flowers of Evil. It was the book they used to signal a meeting.
"I am looking for something else by this author," Anouk said, exhaling smoke. "I am sorry, madame, I have no more Baudelaire, some Verlaine, perhaps, or Rimbaud."
"Nothing, then." Anouk turned and left the bookshop. It wasn't until the bell tinkled that her spell broke and the soldiers began speaking again. When no one was looking, Isabel palmed the small volume of poetry. Inside of it was a message for her to deliver, along with the time it was to be delivered. The place was as usual, the bench in front of the Comédie Française. The message was hidden beneath the end papers, which had been lifted and re-glued dozens of times. Isabel watched the clock, willing the time to advance. She had her next assignment. At precisely 6 p.m., she herded the soldiers out of the bookshop and closed up for the night. Outside, she found the chef and owner of the bistro next door, Monsieur Despard, smoking a cigarette. The poor man looked as tired as she felt. She wondered sometimes, when she saw him sweating over the fryer or shucking oysters, how he felt about feeding Germans.
"Bonsoir, monsieur," she said.
"Bonsoir, mademoiselle."
"Long day?" she commiserated.
"Oui."
She handed him a small used copy of Fables for his children.
"For Jacques and Gigi," she said with a smile.
"One moment."
He rushed into the cafe and returned with a small, grease-stained sack.
"Frites," he said.
Isabel was absurdly grateful. These days she not only ate the enemy's leftovers, she was thankful for them.
"Merci."
Leaving her bicycle in the shop, she decided to ignore the crowded, depressingly silent metro and walk home, enjoying the greasy, salty frites on her way. Everywhere she looked, Germans were pouring into cafes and bistros and restaurants while the ashen-faced Parisians hurried to be home before curfew. Twice along the way, she had a niggling sense that she was being followed, but when she turned, there was no one behind her. She wasn't sure what brought her to a halt on the corner near the park, but all at once, she knew that something was wrong. Out of place, in front of her, the street was full of Nazi vehicles honking at one another. Somewhere someone screamed. Isabel felt the hairs on the back of her neck raise. She glanced back quickly, but no one was behind her. Lately, she often felt as if she were being followed. It was her nerves working overtime. The golden dome of the Invalides shone in the fading rays of the sun. Her heart started pounding. Fear made her perspire. The musky, sour scent of it mingled with the greasy odor of frites, and for a moment her stomach tilted uncomfortably. Everything was fine. No one was following her. She was being foolish. She turned onto Rue de Grenelle. Something caught her eye, made her stop. Up ahead, she saw a shadow where there shouldn't be a shadow. Movement where it should be still. Frowning, she crossed the street, picking her way through the slow-moving traffic. On the other side, she moved briskly past the clot of Germans drinking wine in the bistro toward an apartment building on the next corner. There, hidden in the dense shrubbery beside an ornate set of glossy black doors, she saw a man crouched down behind a tree in a huge copper urn. She opened the gate and stepped into the yard. She heard the man scramble backward, his boots crunching on the stones beneath him. Then he stilled. Isabel could hear the Germans laughing at the cafe down the street, yelling out, "Sieg, s'il vous plaît," to the poor, overworked waitress. It was the supper hour, the one hour of the day when all the enemy cared about was entertainment and stuffing their stomachs with food and wine that belonged to the French. She crept over to the potted lemon tree. The man was squatted down, trying to make himself as small as possible. Dirt smeared his face, and one eye was swollen shut, but there was no mistaking him for a Frenchman. He was wearing a British flight suit.
"Mon Dieu," she muttered. "Anglais?"
He said nothing.
"RAF?"
she asked in English. His eyes widened. She could see him trying to decide whether to trust her. Very slowly, he nodded.
"How long have you been hiding here?"
After a long moment, he said,
"All day."
"You'll get caught," she said, "sooner or later."
Isabel knew she needed to question him further, but there wasn't time. Every second she stood here with him, the danger to both of them increased. It was amazing that the Brit hadn't been caught already. She needed to either help him or walk away before attention was drawn. Certainly walking away was the smart move.
57 Avenue de la Bourdonnais, she said quietly in English. "That's where I am going. In 1 hour, I will go out for a cigarette. You come to the door then. If you arrive without being seen, I will help you. You understand me?"
"How do I know I can trust you?"
She laughed at that.
"This is a foolish thing I am doing. And I promised not to be so impetuous. Ah, well."
She pivoted on her heel and left the garden area, clanging the gate shut behind her. She hurried down the street. All the way home, her heart was pounding, and she second-guessed her decision. But there was nothing to do about it now. She didn't look back, not even at her apartment building. There, she stopped and faced the big brass knob in the center of the oak door. She felt dizzy and headachy, she was so scared. She fumbled with the key in the lock and twisted the knob and surged into the dark, shadowy interior. Inside, the narrow lobby was crowded with bicycles and handcarts. She made her way to the base of the narrow, winding stairway and sat on the bottom step, waiting. She looked at her wristwatch 1,000 times, and each time she told herself not to do this. But at the appointed time, she went back outside. Night had fallen. With the blackout shades and unlit street lamps, the street was as dark as a cave. Cars rumbled past, unseen without their headlamps on, heard and smelled, but invisible unless an errant bit of moonlight caught them. She lit her brown cigarette, took a deep drag, and exhaled slowly, trying to calm herself.
"I'm here, miss."
Isabel stumbled backward and opened the door.
"Stay behind me. Eyes down, not too close."
She led him through the lobby, both of them banging into bicycles, clanging them and rattling wooden carts. She had never run up the 5 flights of stairs faster. She pulled him into her apartment and slammed the door shut behind him.
"Take off your clothes," she said.
"Pardon me?"
She flicked on the light switch. He towered over her, she saw that now. He was broad-shouldered and skinny at the same time, narrow-faced, with a nose that looked like it had been broken a time or two. His hair was so short it looked like fuzz.
"Your flight suit, take it off, quickly."
What had she been thinking to do this? Her father would come home and find the airmen
and then turn them both into the Germans. Where would she hide his flight suit? And those boots were a dead giveaway. He bent forward and stepped out of his flight suit. She had never seen a grown man in his undershorts and t-shirt before. She felt her face flush.
"No need to blush, miss," he said, grinning as if this were ordinary.
She yanked his suit into her arms and held out her hand for his identification tags. He handed them over, two small discs worn around his neck. Both contained the same information. Lieutenant Torrance McLeish. His blood group and religion and number.
"Follow me, quietly.
What's the word? On the edges of your toes."
"Tiptoes," he whispered.
She led him to her bedroom. There, slowly, gently, she pushed the armoire out of the way and revealed the secret room. A row of glassy doll eyes stared back at her.
"That's creepy, miss," he said. "And it's a small space for a big man."
"Get in. Stay quiet. Any untoward sound could get us searched. Madame Leclerc next door is curious and could be a collaborator, do you understand? Also, my father will be home soon. He works for the German High Command."
"Blimey."
She had no idea what that meant, and she was sweating so profusely her clothes were starting to stick to her chest. What had she been thinking to offer this man help?
"What if I have to, you know?" he asked.
"Hold it."
She pushed him into the room, giving him a pillow and blanket from her bed.
"I'll come back when I can. Quiet, oui?"
He nodded.
"Thank you."
She couldn't help shaking her head.
"I am a fool. A fool!"
She shut the door on him and shoved the armoire back into place, not quite where it went, but good enough for now. She had to get rid of his flight suit and tags before her father came home. She moved through the apartment on bare feet, as quietly as possible. She had no idea if the people downstairs would notice the sound of the armoire being moved, or too many people moving about up here. Better safe than sorry. She jammed the flight suit in an old Samaritan department store bag and crushed it to her chest. Leaving the apartment felt dangerous suddenly. So did staying. She crept past the Leclerc apartment and then rushed down the stairs. Outside, she drew in a gulping breath. Now what? She couldn't throw this just anywhere. She didn't want someone else to get in trouble. For the first time, she was grateful for the city's blackout conditions. She slipped into the darkness on the sidewalk and all but disappeared. There were few Parisians out this close to curfew, and the Germans were too busy drinking French wine to glance outside. She drew in a deep breath, trying to calm down, to think. She was probably moments away from curfew, although that was hardly her biggest problem. Papa would be home soon. The river. She was only a few blocks away, and there were trees along the quay. She found a smaller, barricaded side street and made her way to the river, past the row of military lorries parked along the street. She had never moved so slowly in her life. One step, one breath, at a time. The last 50 feet between her and the banks of the Seine seemed to grow and expand with each step she took, and then again as she descended the stairs to the water. But at last she was there, standing beside the river. She heard boat lines creaking in the darkness, waves slapping their wooden hulls. Once again, she thought she heard footsteps behind her. When she stilled, so did they. She waited for someone to come up behind her, for a voice demanding her papers. Nothing. She was imagining it. 1 minute passed, then another. She threw the bag into the black water and then hurled the identification tags in after it. The dark, swirling water swallowed the evidence instantly. Still, she felt shaky as she climbed the steps and crossed the street and headed for home. At her apartment door, She paused, finger-combing her sweat-dampened hair and pulling the damp cotton blouse from her breasts. The one light was on, the chandelier. Her father sat hunched over the dining room table, with paperwork spread out before him. He appeared haggard and too thin. She wondered suddenly how much he had been eating lately. In the weeks she'd been home, she had not once seen him have a meal. They ate, like they did everything else, separately. She had assumed that he ate German scraps at the high command. Now she wondered.
"You're late," he said harshly.
She noticed the brandy bottle on the table. It was half empty. Yesterday, it had been full. How was it that he always found his brandy?
"The Germans wouldn't leave."
She moved toward the table and put several franc notes down.
"Today was a good day. I see your friends at the High Command have given you more brandy."
"The Nazis do not give much away," he said.
"Indeed. So you have earned it."
A noise sounded, something crashing to the hardwood floor, maybe.
"What was that?"
her father said, looking up. Then came another sound, like a scraping of wood on wood.
"Someone is in this apartment," Papa said.
"Don't be absurd, Papa."
He rose quickly from the table and left the room. Isabel rushed after him.
"Papa!"
"Hush,"
he hissed. He moved down the entryway, into the unlit part of the apartment. At the Bombay chest near the front door, he picked up a candle in a brass holder and lit it.
"Surely you don't think someone has broken in?" she said.
He threw her a harsh, narrow-eyed look.
"I will not ask you to be silent again. Now hold your tongue."
His breath smelled of brandy and cigarettes.
"But why?"
"Shut up."
He turned his back on her and moved down the narrow, slanted floor hallway toward the bedrooms. He passed the minuscule coat closet, nothing but coats inside, and followed the candle's quavering path into Vianne's old room. It was empty but for the bed and nightstand and writing desk. Nothing was out of place in here. He got slowly to his knees and looked under the bed. Satisfied at last that the room was empty, he headed for Isabel's room. Could he hear the pounding of her heart? He checked her room. Under the bed. Behind the door. Behind the floor-to-ceiling damask curtains that framed the blacked-out courtyard window. Isabel forced herself not to stare at the armoire.
"See?"
she said loudly, hoping the airmen would hear voices and sit still.
"No one is here. Really, Papa, working for the enemy is making you paranoid."
He turned to her. In the corona of candlelight, his face looked haggard and worn.
"It wouldn't hurt you to be afraid, you know."
Was that a threat?
"Of you, Papa, or of the Nazis?"
"Are you paying no attention at all, Isabel? You should be afraid of everyone. Now, get out of my way. I need a drink."
Chapter 18. Isabel lay in bed, listening. When she was sure her father was asleep, a drunken sleep, no doubt, she left her bed, went in search of her grandmère's porcelain chamber pot, and holding it, stood in front of the armoire. Slowly, a half inch at a time, she moved it away from the wall, just enough to open the hidden door. Inside, it was dark and quiet. Only when she listened intently did she hear him breathing.
"Monsieur,"
she whispered.
"Hello, miss,"
came at her from the dark. She lit the oil lamp by her bed and carried it into the space. He was sitting against the wall, with his legs stretched out. In the candlelight, he seemed softer somehow, younger. She handed him the chamber pot and saw that color rose on his cheeks as he took it from her.
"Thank you."
She sat down opposite him.
"I got rid of your identification tags and flight suit. Your boots will have to be cut down for you to wear. Here is a knife. Tomorrow morning, I will get you some of my father's clothes. I don't imagine they'll fit well. He nodded, saying,
And what is your plan?
That made her smile nervously.
I'm not sure. You are a pilot?
Lieutenant Torrance McLeish, RAF. My aeroplane went down over Reims.
And you've been on your own since then? In your flight suit?
Fortunately, my brother and I played hide-and-seek a lot when we were lads.
You're not safe here.
I gathered.
He smiled, and it changed his face, reminded her that he was really just a young man far from home.
If it makes you feel better, I took 3 German aeroplanes down with me.
You need to get back to Britain so you can get back to it.
I can't agree more, but how? The whole coastline is behind barbed wire and patrolled by dogs. I can't exactly leave France by boat or air.
I have some friends who are working on this. We will go see them tomorrow.
You are very brave, he said softly.
Or foolish, she said, unsure of which was more true. I have often heard I'm impetuous and unruly. I imagine I will hear it from my friends tomorrow.
Well, miss, you won't hear anything but brave from me.
The next morning, Isabel heard her father walk past her room. Moments later, she smelled coffee wafting her way, and then, after that, the front door clicked shut. She left her room and went into her father's, which was a mess of clothes on the floor and an unmade bed, with an empty brandy bottle lying on its side on his writing desk. She pulled the blackout shade and peered past the empty balcony to the street below, where she saw her father emerge out onto the sidewalk. He had his black briefcase held close to his chest, as if his poetry actually mattered to anyone, and a black hat pulled low on his brow. Hunched like an overworked secretary, he headed for the metro. When he passed out of her view, she went to the armoire in his room and rummaged through it for old clothes. A shapeless turtleneck sweater with fraying sleeves, old corduroy pants, patched in the seat and bereft of several buttons, and a gray beret. Isabel cautiously moved the armoire and opened the door. The secret room smelled of sweat and piss, so much that she had to clamp her hand over her nose and mouth as she gagged.
Sorry, miss, McLeish said sheepishly.
Put these on. Wash up there at the pitcher, and meet me in the salon. Put the armoire back. Move quietly. People are downstairs. They may know my father is gone and expect only one person to be walking around up here.
Moments later, he stepped into the kitchen, dressed in her father's cast-offs. He looked like a fairy tale boy who'd sprouted overnight. The sweater strained across his broad chest, and the corduroy pants were too small to button at the waist. He was wearing the beret flat on the crown of his head, as if it were a yarmulke. This would never work. How would she get him across town in broad daylight?
I can do this, he said. I'll follow along behind you. Trust me, miss. I've been walking about in a flight suit. This is easy.
It was too late to back out now. She'd taken him in and hidden him. Now she needed to get him someplace safe.
Walk at least a block behind me. If I stop, you stop.
If I get pinched, you keep walking. Don't even look back.
Pinched must mean arrested. She went to him, adjusted his beret, set it at a jaunty angle. Her gaze held his.
Where are you from, Lieutenant McLeish?
Ipswich, miss. You'll tell my parents, if necessary.
It won't be necessary, Lieutenant.
She drew in a deep breath. He had reminded her again of the risk that she'd undertaken to help him. The false papers in her handbag, identifying her as Juliette Gervais of Nice, baptized in Marseille, and a student at the Sorbonne, were the only protection she had if the worst happened. She went to the front door, opened it, and peered out. The landing was empty.
She shoved him out, saying, "Go! Stand outside by the milliner's empty shop, then follow me." He stumbled out of the apartment, and she closed the door behind him. 1, 2, 3. She counted silently, imagining trouble with every step. When she could stand it no more, she left the apartment and went down the stairs. All was quiet. She found him outside, standing where he'd been told to. She lifted her chin and walked past him without a glance. All the way to the Saint-Germain, she walked briskly, never turning around, never looking back. Several times she heard German soldiers yell out, "Halt!" and blow their whistles. Twice she heard gunshots, but she neither slowed nor looked. By the time she reached the red door at the apartment on Rue de Saint-Simon, she was sweating and a little lightheaded. She knocked 4 times in rapid succession. The door opened. Anouk appeared in the slit of an opening. Surprise widened her eyes. She opened the door and stepped back. "What are you doing here?" Behind her, several of the men Isabel had met before were seated around tables, with maps set out in front of them, the pale blue lines illuminated by candlelight. Anouk started to shut the door. Isabel said, "Leave it open." Tension followed her directive. She saw it sweep the room, change the expressions around her. At the table, Monsieur Levy began putting the maps away. Isabel glanced outside and saw MacLeish coming up the walkway. He stepped into the apartment, and she slammed the door shut behind him. No one spoke. Isabel had their full attention.
"This is Lieutenant Torrance MacLeish of the RAF. Pilot. I found him hiding in the bushes near my apartment last night."
"And you brought him here," Anouk said, lighting a cigarette.
"He needs to get back to Britain," Isabel said.
"I thought..." "No," Anouk said. "You did not."
Levy sat back in his chair and pulled a Galoise from his breast pocket and lit it up, studying the airmen.
"There are others that we know of in the city, and more who escaped from German prisons. We want to get them out, but the coasts and the airfields are sewn up tight."
He took a long drag on his cigarette. The tip glowed and crackled and blackened.
"It is a problem we have been working on."
"I know," Isabel said evenly. She felt the full weight of her responsibility. Had she acted rashly again? Were they disappointed in her?
She didn't know. Should she have ignored MacLeish? She was about to ask a question when she heard someone talking in another room. Frowning, she said,
"Who else is here?"
"Others," Levy answered. "Others are always here. No one of concern to you."
"We need a plan for the airmen, it is true," Anouk said.
"We believe we could get them out of Spain," Levy said, "if we could get them into Spain."
"The Pyrenees," Anouk said.
Isabel had seen the Pyrenees, so she understood Anouk's comment. The jagged peaks rose impossibly high into the clouds and were usually snow-covered or ringed in fog. Her mother had loved Biarritz, a small coastal town nearby, and twice, in the good days long ago, the family had vacationed there.
"The border with Spain is guarded by both German and Spanish patrols," Anouk said. "The whole border?"
Isabel asked.
"Well, no, of course not. But where they are and where they aren't, who knows?" Levy said.
"The mountains are smaller near Saint-Jean-de-Luz," Isabel pointed out.
"Oui, but so what? They are still impassable, and the few roads are guarded," Anouk said.
"My maman's best friend was a Basque, whose father was a goat-herder. He crossed the mountains on foot all the time."
"We have had this idea." "We even tried it once," Levy said. "None of the party was heard from again. Getting past the German sentries at Saint-Jean-de-Luz is hard enough for one man, let alone several. And then there is the actual crossing of the mountains on foot. It is nearly impossible."
Nearly impossible and impossible are not the same thing. If goat herders can cross the mountains, certainly airmen can do it, Isabel said. As she said it, an idea came to her. And a woman could move easily across the checkpoints, especially a young woman. No one would suspect a pretty girl. Anouk and Levi exchanged a look. I will do it, Isabel said. Or try it anyway. I'll take this airman. And are there others? Monsieur Levi frowned. Obviously, this turn of events surprised him. Cigarette smoke clouded blue-gray between them.
And you have climbed mountains before?
I'm in good shape, was her answer.
If they catch you, they'll imprison you, or kill you, he said quietly. Put your impetuousness aside for a moment and think on that, Isabel. This is not handing over a piece of paper. You have seen the signs posted all over town? The rewards offered for people who aid the enemy?
Isabel nodded earnestly. Anouk sighed heavily, stabbing out her cigarette in the overflowing ashtray. She gazed at Isabel a long time, eyes narrowing. Then she walked to the door behind the table. She pushed the door open a little and whistled, gave a trilling little bird call. Isabel frowned. She heard something in the other room, a chair pushing back from a table, footsteps. Gaetan stepped into the room. He was dressed shabbily, in corduroy pants that were patched at the knees and ragged at the hem and a little too short, in a sweater that hung on his wiry frame, its collar pulled out of shape. His black hair, longer now, in need of cutting, had been slicked back from his face, which was sharper, almost wolf-like. He looked at her as if they were the only two in the room. In an instant, it was all undone. The feelings she'd discounted, tried to bury, to ignore, came flooding back. One look at him, and she could barely breathe.
You know Gate, Anouk said.
Isabel cleared her throat. She understood that he'd known she was here all along, that he'd chosen to stay away from her. For the first time since she'd joined this underground group, Isabel felt keenly young, apart. Had they all known about it? Had they laughed about her naivete behind her back?
I do.
So, Levi said after an uncomfortable pause, Isabel has a plan.
Gaetan didn't smile.
Does she? She wants to lead this airman and others across the Pyrenees on foot and get them into Spain. To the British consulate, I assume.
Gaetan swore under his breath.
We need to try something, Levi said.
Do you truly understand the risk, Isabel?
Anouk asked, coming forward.
If you succeed, the Nazis will hear of it. They will hunt you down. There is a 10,000-franc reward for anyone who leads the Nazis to someone aiding airmen.
Isabel had always simply reacted in her life. Someone left her behind, she followed. Someone told her she couldn't do something, she did it. Every barrier, she turned into a gate. But this. She let fear give her a little shake, and she almost gave in to it. Then she thought about the swastikas that flew from the Eiffel Tower, and Vianne living with the enemy, and Antoine lost in some prisoner of war camp, and Edith Cavell. Certainly, she had been afraid sometimes, too. Isabel would not let fear stand in her way. The airmen were needed in Britain to drop more bombs on Germany. Isabel turned to the airman.
Are you a fit man, Lieutenant? She said in English. Could you keep up with a girl on a mountain crossing?
I could, he said. Especially one as pretty as you, miss. I wouldn't let you out of my sight.
Isabel faced her compatriots.
I'll take him to the consulate in San Sebastian. From there, it will be up to the Brits to get him home.
Isabel saw the conversation that passed in silence around her, concerns and questions unvoiced. A decision reached in silence. Some risks simply had to be taken. Everyone in this room knew it.
It will take weeks to plan. Maybe longer, Levy said.
He turned to Gaetan.
We will need money immediately. You will speak to your contact?
Gaetan nodded. He grabbed a black beret from the sideboard, putting it on. Isabel couldn't look away. She was angry at him. She knew that, felt it. But as he came toward her, that anger dried up and blew away like dust, beneath the longing that mattered so much more. Their gazes met, held, and then he was past her, reaching for the doorknob, going outside. The door clicked shut behind him.
So, Anouk said, the planning. We should begin.
For 6 hours, Isabel sat at the table in the apartment on Rue de Saint-Simon. They brought in others from the network and gave them tasks. To gather clothes for the pilots and stockpile supplies, they consulted maps and devised routes and began the long, uncertain process of setting up safe houses along the way. At some point, they began to see it as a reality instead of merely a bold and daring idea. It wasn't until Monsieur Levy mentioned the curfew that Isabel pushed back from the table. They tried to talk her into staying the night, but such a choice would make her father suspicious. Instead, she borrowed a heavy black peacoat from Anouk and put it on, grateful for the way it camouflaged her. The Boulevard Saint-Germain was eerily quiet, shutters closed tightly and blacked out, street lamps dark. She kept close to the buildings, grateful that the worn-down heels of her white Oxfords didn't clatter on the sidewalk. She crept past barricades and around groups of German soldiers patrolling the streets. She was almost home when she heard an engine growling. A German lorry shambled up the street behind her, its blue-painted headlights turned off. She pressed flat against the rough stone wall behind her, and the phantom lorry rolled past, grumbling in the darkness. Then everything was silent again. A bird whistled, a trilling song, familiar. Isabel knew then that she'd been waiting for him, hoping. She straightened slowly, rose to her feet. Beside her, a potted plant released the scent of flowers.
Isabel, Gaetan said.
She could barely make out his features in the dark, but she could smell the pomade in his hair and the rough scent of his laundry soap and the cigarette he'd smoked some time ago.
How did you know I was working with Paul? Who do you think recommended you?
She frowned.
Henri. And who told Henri about you? I had Didier following you from the beginning, watching over you. I knew you would find your way to us.
He reached out, tucked the hair behind her ears, and the intimacy of the act left her parched with hope. She remembered saying, I love you, and shame and loss twisted her up inside. She didn't want to remember how he'd made her feel, how he'd fed her roasted rabbit by hand and carried her when she was too tired to walk and showed her how much one kiss could matter.
I'm sorry I hurt you, he said.
Why did you?
It doesn't matter now, he sighed. I should have stayed in that back room today. It's better not seeing you.
Not for me.
He smiled.
You have a habit of saying whatever is on your mind, don't you, Isabel?
Always. Why did you leave me?
He touched her face with a gentleness that made her want to cry. It felt like a goodbye, that touch, and she knew goodbye.
I wanted to forget you.
She wanted to say something more, maybe kiss me, or don't go, or say I matter to you. But it was already too late. The moment, whatever it was past. He was stepping away from her, disappearing into the shadows. He said softly,
Be careful, Iz.
And before she could answer, she knew he was gone. She felt his absence in her bones. She waited a moment more, for her heartbeat to slow down and her emotions to stabilize. Then she headed for home. She had barely released the lock on her front door when she felt herself being yanked inside. The door slammed shut behind her.
Where in the hell have you been?
Her father's alcoholic breath washed over her, its sweetness a cloak over something dark, bitter, as if he'd been chewing aspirin. She tried to pull free, but he held her so close it was almost an embrace, his grasp on her wrist tight enough to leave a bruise. Then, as quickly as he'd grasped her, he let her go. She stumbled back, flailing for the light switch. When she flipped it, nothing happened.
No more money for electricity, her father said.
He lit an oil lamp, held it between them. In the wavering light, he looked to be sculpted of melting wax. His lined face sagged. His eyelids were puffy and a little blue. His paddle nose showed black pores the size of pinheads. Even with all of that, with as tired and old as he suddenly seemed, it was the look in his eyes that made her frown. Something was wrong.
Come with me,
he said, his voice raspy and sharp, unrecognizable this time of night without a slur. He led her down past the closet and around the corner to her room. Inside, he turned to look at her. Behind him, in the lamp's glow, she saw the moved armoire and the door to the secret room ajar. The smell of urine was strong. Thank God the airman was gone. Isabel shook her head, unable to speak. He sank to sit on the edge of her bed, bowing his head.
Christ, Isabel, you are a pain in the ass.
She couldn't move or think. She glanced at the bedroom door, wondering if she could make it out of the apartment.
It was nothing, Papa. A boy. A date. We were kissing, Papa.
And do all of your dates piss in the closet? You must be very popular then.
He sighed.
Enough of this charade.
Charade?
You found an airman last night and hid him in the closet, and today you took him to Monsieur Lavie.
Isabel could not have heard correctly.
Pardon?
Your downed airman, the one who pissed in the closet and left dirty boot prints in the hallway. You took him to Monsieur Lavie.
I do not know what you are talking about.
Good for you, Isabel.
When he fell silent, she couldn't stand the suspense.
Papa?
I know you came here as a courier for the underground, and that you are working with Paul Lévy's network.
How?
Monsieur Lavie is an old friend. In fact, when the Nazis invaded, he came to me and pulled me out of the bottle of brandy. That was all I cared about. He put me to work.
Isabel felt so unsteady, she couldn't stand. It was too intimate to sit by her father, so she sank slowly to the carpet.
I didn't want you involved in this, Isabel. That's why I sent you from Paris in the first place. I didn't want to put you at risk with my work. I should have known you'd find your own way to danger.
And all the other times you sent me away?
She wished instantly that she hadn't asked the question. But the moment she had the thought, it was given voice.
I am no good as a father. We both know that. At least not since your maman's death.
How would we know? You never tried.
I tried. You just don't remember. Anyway, that is all water gone by now. We have bigger concerns.
We,
she said. Her past felt upended somehow, off balance. She didn't know what to think or feel. Better to change the subject than to dwell on it.
I am planning something. I will be gone for a while.
He looked down at her.
I know. I have spoken to Paul.
He was silent for a long moment.
You know that your life changes right now. You will have to live underground, not here with me, not with anyone. You will not be able to spend more than a few nights in any one place. You will trust absolutely no one. And you will not be Isabel Rossignol at all anymore. You will be Juliette Gervais. The Nazis and the collaborators will always be searching for you,
And if they find you...
Isabel nodded. A look passed between them. In it, Isabel felt a connection that had never existed before.
You know that prisoners of war receive some mercy. You can expect none.
She nodded.
Can you do this, Isabel?
I can do it, Papa.
He nodded.
The name you are looking for is Micheline Babineau. Your maman's friend in Orogne. Her husband was killed in the Great War. I think she would welcome you. And tell Paul I will need photographs immediately.
Photographs?
Of the airmen.
At her continued silence, he finally smiled.
Really, Isabel? Have you not put the pieces together?
But...
I forge papers, Isabel. That's why I work at the High Command. I began by writing the very tracts you distributed in Garivaux. But it turns out that the poet has a forger's hand. Who do you think gave you the name Juliette Gervais?
But...
You believed I collaborated with the enemy. I can hardly blame you.
In him, suddenly, she saw someone foreign. A broken man, where a cruel, careless man had always stood. She dared to rise up, to move toward him, to kneel in front of him. She stared up at him, feeling hot tears glaze her eyes.
Why did you push me and Vian away?
I hope you never know how fragile you are, Isabel.
I'm not fragile, she said.
The smile he gave her was barely one at all.
We are all fragile, Isabel. It's the thing we learn in war.